Welcome, everyone, to our PA Communities Learning Program Monday night, our new 7 o'clock time. I'm excited to have everyone. And I just want to quickly dedicate tonight's shir, that the schus, the merit of our learning, should be for all of those in Eretz Yisrael, Achenu, Beis Yisrael, Be'eretz Yisrael, all our brothers and sisters who are recovering, who are hospitalized, who are traumatized, and of course, those who have lost their lives. This should be an aliyah, an elevation for their souls. And we wish for nothing more than shalom in Eretz Yisrael, for Achenu Beis Yisrael, Be'eretz Yisrael. So that said, let me read you the Parsha summary, very short and succinct. Aaron is commanded to raise light in the lamps of the menorah, and the tribe of Levi is initiated into the service in the tabernacle, the sanctuary, the Mishkan. A second Passover, Pesach Sheni, is instituted in response to the petition. Why should we be deprived, the people asked, by a group of Jews who were unable to bring the Passover offering in its appointed time because they were ritually impure? Hashem instructs Moshe on the procedures for Israel's journeys and encampments in the desert. And the people journey in formation from Mount Sinai, where they had been camped for nearly a year since Matan Torah, since Shavuos, since the first giving of the Torah. The people are dissatisfied with their bread from heaven, the manna. And they did what a lot of Jews like to do. They kvetched, they complained, and demand that Moshe supply them with meat. Moshe, of course, doesn't know where he's going to get that amount of meat. As a response to Moshe's upset, shall we say, at that meat declaration and a rejection of his manna, which was his schus, his merit, that the manna fell, he appoints 70 elders to whom he imparts of his spirit, the Ruach HaKodesh, to assist him in the burden of governing the people. And then the Parsha ends with Miriam speaking negatively of Moshe. She is punished with saras, with leprosy. Moshe says very short words, Kelna Rifana Lo. 5 words. Hashem, please heal her. And the entire community waits 7 days for Miriam's recovery. Okay, so that is, from beginning to end, our Parsha Bahaloska. But I want to focus tonight on the following question. It's going to sound silly. It's going to sound very similar to, like, you know, when you were a kid and people said, hey, who's buried in General Grant's tomb? When was the War of 1812? If you recall, when you were about 11 years old, that was a very big riddle that was hopefully answered correctly by people who realized the humor. So here is the humor in tonight's question. How many books are there? How many sefers are there in the Chumash? So again, one would say, wait a minute, Kaplan, this is a trick question. Chumash, Chamesh, who knows 5? I know 5. I'm up that late for the Seder. Chamisha Chumshe Sorah. 5 are the books of the Torah from the word Chamesh. What if I told you there are actually 7 books in the Torah? Now, before you retire and say, I think I've heard enough of this, let me explain. Chazal identify 3 parts of the 4th book that we're in right now, the Midbar, Numbers, as actually having 3 sections. You have the Midbar 1, the first section of the Midbar, which is up to our Parsha here, Baloscha, in the middle of our Parsha. And then you have, after a short break in the action, Bamidbar, Numbers 2, from that point to the end of the Chumash. And then right in the middle, you have a couple of psukim, just a few short verses, which are considered their own sefer, their own entity, their own unique book. So if you add up Numbers number 1 and 2, along with this little hidden extra book, you come up with the magic number 7. Now, what is this book? So if everyone could look at source number 2 on your screen, I'm going to scroll it down now, okay? It's actually, everyone sees where my mouse is, my mouse cursor. It's actually a little picture that I got out of somewhere on Google of an actual Sefer Torah. So you will notice that some of the letters, like the Nuns and the Ayins and the Ches, they have the little tagin, the little crowns that we once spoke about in connection with Rabbi Akiva. And you notice right here, and it's circled, there is an inverted, an upside down letter Nun. And then at the end of this little segment, everyone sees it's also circled, makes it really easy, a second inverted, upside-down Nun. These two Nuns, sans the circles, of course, are actually to be found in a real Sefer Torah. If you will actually look in a Torah, you will see that this Nun that begins this little section and the second Nun which ends it are sort of a graphic delineation between the beginning and end of this short little section. And it's a very famous section because we have a great tune to this. When we bring the Sefer Torah out on Shabbos, what do we famously sing? Vayehi b'nso Aharon, vayomer Moshe, kuma Hashem, right? So you have this famous little area that is surrounded by the two inverted Nuns, hafuchot. And it begins with, I even saw Aaron, and so it was, and it's in English right here on source one. So it was, whenever the ark set out, Moshe would say, Kuma Hashem, arise, O Lord. V'yafutzu eivecha, may your enemies be scattered. Right? And then it goes on to say, V'yanusu Misanecha mipanecha, those who hate you, may they flee from you. And then it ends right there at the end of that next little thing, Uvenucho Yomar, Shuva Hashem Revivos Alfei Israel, and that ends this little section. Believe it or not, I know this is wild, this little section that is surrounded by the Nun and the Nun is actually its own Sefer. And the rabbis actually deduce, la halacha, for Jewish law, certain things about what makes a Sefer Torah an actual kosher Torah that we can read from, based on how many letters are in this little section. So in other words, this somehow is here for a mysterious reason. So why is it here? Let's look at source number two. So it was, whenever the ark set out, he, Hashem, made marks for it, for this verse. Marks are referring, of course, to the Nuns. Before it and after it, as if to indicate that this is not its proper place in the Torah. So why was it written here then? Why is this little section by Yibin Saharon, why is it here at all? To make a break between one punishment and the next punishment. We didn't want to have a chazaka. I'm sure you know, you've heard the idea that if something happens three times, you do something three times, it becomes an established fact on the ground. And we didn't want to have three consecutive puranut, three consecutive punishments for the Jewish people, lest it become a chazaka for them, an established fact that would always be this negativity when they left Mount Sinai. Now, the rabbis debate about what the first punishment was. The following two are easy. They complain, basically about nothing, about the travel, and then they complain about the manna. So the last two are very easy. What happened before Vayibin So Aaron that necessitated the break in the action? It's not clear at all. And just to reiterate again, so everyone is clear, Vayehi b'nso Aharon deals with the travels of the ark. So if you're Harrison Ford, please pay very close attention to this for the Raiders of the Lost Ark. This little section properly belonged earlier in the book when we were dealing with the encampments and how they traveled and how the ark would be disassembled, reassembled, carried by Shevet Levi, wherever they would go. It doesn't belong in this point in time. Therefore, it's jettisoned in here to separate that we should not have these tragic three puranut, punishments, that would be illustrative of a pattern that would not just be a one-time occurrence, but a chazaka, an established fact. So what was the first issue? You know what the first issue was? And the rabbis look long and hard. It's how they left Mount Sinai. You see, they were like, and it fits magically into the time of year, Bahaloscha is always read June, May, June, the end of May like it is this year, or early June like it is in coming years. What else happens in June when you're a child? School gets out. And if you've ever witnessed the last day of school, if you're a teacher perhaps, and you were there in the building, and it's 5 to 3, and the children are anticipating the final dismissal for summer, those doors blow open, and I dare say you do not want to be doing crowd control outside of those steps leading down from the school on the last day. And the rabbis actually use this quote. They say that when the Jewish people left Sinai, they did not do it with proper honor and respect, with kavod. Oh, we wish we could stay with you, Hashem. It's been such a fabulous thing. Mount Sinai, the revelation. Wow, if only we could stay here forever. No, no, no. You know how they left? Like those kids blow through those doors on the last day of school. Kitinok shenivrach mi beit sefer. Literally the words of Chazal, the rabbis. Like a little kid running away from school for fear that the teacher might grab him and give him some summer work to do. Oh my gosh, if we stay at Sinai any longer, the people thought, maybe that number 613 is going to increase. God forbid, right? Let's get out of here. Come on, we only have 613. Let's scram. So did they have anywhere to go? No. And we know that as soon as they leave, they start kvetching, what any good Jew does, about the travel itself and how they were pushed to move to get into Israel. They complained about the travel. So in other words, they're stationary for a year. They kvetch. I don't want to be here anymore. Let's get out of here. And when they're given the opportunity to let loose, boom, they blow through the doors, the metaphorical doors from Mount Sinai. And yet when they get away from Sinai, they start to complain because why are we moving so fast? So in other words, it wasn't that they wanted to get anywhere. They just wanted not to be at Sinai, which bitterly and ironically is brought home because what happens in the next parsha after Bahaloscha? The spies. What happens as a result? The end game. The punishment? If you guys just kind of don't want to go anywhere, you kind of just wander around and you're happy just wandering around, okay, Hashem says, how about you wander around for 40 years and drop dead? And let's wait for the next generation, and they'll be able to go to Israel because they have a purpose. They want to go somewhere. So you see that this little Vayehi bin So'aron is to sort of historically stop the bleeding. It didn't work. It's there graphically, of course. And yes, I understand that in theory it didn't have three consecutive issues, but I have to say, and this is what we're going to discuss tonight very briefly, the whole problem of the Jewish people's inability to stay at Sinai, what they really rejected at Sinai, bled through, and it carried on in this week's Parsha, tragically in the next Parsha with spies, and Ad Hayom Hazeh, until this very day, literally, we are still struggling with this same issue, as we will discover. Okay? I'm going to now go down to source number 3, and because of time constraints, I'm just going to read it for you in English, and then you may notice that I embolden, the Hebrew is always above the source in English. The second line of Hebrew is embolden. Zacharno et adaga asher nocha b'Mitzrayim chinam. But the multitude among them began to have strong cravings. The Jewish people have journeyed forth from Sinai. They already kvetched about the traveling, and now they're kvetching about the manna. Then even the children of Israel once again began to cry. Listen to their complaint. And they said, who will feed us meat? Zacharnu, We remember that people cried out, the fish that we ate in Egypt free of charge. Ah, the cucumbers, the watermelons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now, here in the desert, our bodies are dried out. For there is nothing at all. We have nothing but manna to look at. Now, ladies and gentlemen, manna was magical. It could literally take on, like astronaut food, the taste or flavor of any known substance in the world, with the exception of these substances that are listed in the complaint. The cucumbers, watermelons, leeks, onions, and garlic. Why? So Chazal, I won't bore you with this, but the rabbis basically say anything that could be injurious to a baby in the womb, for a mother's milk would be sort of take on that flavor. If somehow garlic maybe wasn't so healthy for the baby or for the embryo, the manna would not take that flavor on to protect the little baby or the embryo. Again, we can have a dialogue one day about cucumbers and watermelons and leeks and onions and garlic for the babies, but just suffice it to say that if the manna could replicate the flavor and taste of 8 million foods, these are the only ones they could not. So, of course, what did they see? As Rabbi Larry Kaplan always likes to use as a mashal, a person will walk into a room, beautiful synagogue, they look up the tiled roof, and there are 4,000 immaculate tiles. What tile do they see? The one broken tile in the corner. They say, ach, look at this. Oh, I've said it. Oh, my gosh, look at the broken tile up there in the corner. And you say, excuse me, but there's 3,999 perfect tiles. You have to hone in on the one that's negative? This is exactly what the people did here, honing in on some negative characteristic, which really wasn't real, about the manna. So Rashi then goes on to explain that when they created this complaint, it was a big fat lie. It wasn't real. We ate fish in Egypt free of charge. And Rashi, I'll just paraphrase, he says, now wait a minute. Pharaoh didn't give them free straw, but he gave them Alaskan king salmon? I mean, seriously? You want us to believe that when you were slaves, avadim lefaro b'mitzrayim, you were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, straw he made you gather yourself, but delicious ahi tuna and king salmon and, you know, skinless boneless sardines, all of those things, yeah, like he gave them to you for free, correct? Really? We're supposed to believe this? So again, this is the beginning of the end for the Jewish people, unfortunately. Now, why do I say that? This connects all the way through up to and including the ninth day of Av. And I'll show you how. What word did we use in the verse? Remember, it's a loaded word. The people specifically targeted the manna and their complaint, the kvetch about the manna, with that word chinam, for free. We had fish for free, and now all we have is this manna. Like, it's boring, it's horrible, doesn't taste like all the fancy taste that I enjoy, right? And they claimed that they had fish for free, which was debunked by Rashi and the other commentators. So not only is the complaint rude and chutzpahdik, it's audacious, but what makes it worse is that's a lie. They're literally maligning the magic food of heaven, the manna. So what does chinam mean? What does it mean something is free? So here is where it gets really sadly interesting. So the word chinam means free of reality. It's not true. It's free from emes, from truth. And we know that in one parsha, Shlach, you're going to have the spies. And they're going to come back and they're going to make up this whole story about the land of Israel, Canaan. And then what do the people do in response to that nefarious report? They issue forth a bichiyah shel chinam, a cry for free. Chinam, it's the same word that is opened here in our parsha Balosta. Chinam. They cried for no reason. And we all remember from our Tisha B'Av studies that what was the cause, the root cause of the destruction of temple number 2? Sinas chinam. Baseless, free hatred. So it's the same word. Chinam, chinam, chinam. Fish for free. free cry for no reason. In other words, you're crying when you should be celebrating the imminent arrival to Israel. And then, of course, the baseless hatred, the free hatred between Jew and Jew, leading ultimately to the Churban Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of our world, of Jerusalem, and everything we know. So let me give you a little hypothesis here. Remember we pointed out with the inverted nuns that there's a whole little section of Torah that takes us from Sinai, and it separates the event at Sinai, the negative way the Jewish people ran away from Sinai, like the little kids on the last day of school. They just said, I'm getting the heck out of here, and boom! They're running away from Sinai, but they had no place to go. They had no goal in mind. They just didn't want to be there. What was it about Sinai, do you think, that they couldn't handle? So here's my hypothesis. Reality. You see, the Torah and God's existence in our world was so real. The truth of the Torah and of what it meant to have this bris, this relationship between God and the people, was so real that the people almost felt coerced. That's why I'm sure you've heard that when it came time for the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, the people kind of felt like there was like this mountain hanging over their head, which was not real, it was metaphorical, because the truth of the Torah was so overwhelming. How could any sane human being not accept the Torah? It's truth, and the truth was so real to the people, but they couldn't handle the truth. I think that was maybe Tom Cruise or something, maybe in A Few Good Men. You can't handle the truth, okay? They couldn't handle the truth, so they got to get away from the truth. So they run out the door from Sinai just to get away from MS. Oh, just as a sidelight, when they couldn't handle the truth, what did they build at the foot of Mount Sinai, because Moshe's a couple minutes late? The golden calf. Do you want to guess what the golden calf is an ultimate expression of? Idolatry? Non-reality. The biggest fake-out of all is Avodah Zarah, is idolatry. There isn't a bigger fake-out in non-reality in the world. So literally, while they're at Sinai, and they have like a little respite, because maybe Moses isn't there, they immediately are desirous of a fake-out, non-reality. And they have the calf. Okay, but they somehow overcome the calf, because there's Moshe, he comes back, he davens, it works out, it's okay, they have Yom Kippur. But they were still, they felt imprisoned by the truth, the emes of reality. They couldn't handle the truth, and they ran away. And that's why I would lay the claim the following. Vayehi bin Soaron, Vayomer Moshe. We say this when we bring the Torah out, correct? So this, it's not just what is separating the fact, part one punishment from part two and three. The verses chosen by God relate directly to taking the Torah out, the truth of the Torah. In other words, he could have chosen anything to sort of jettison in there and separate, but why did he choose the verses that we do when we open the Ark and we look at the Torah of God, which is Emes, Torah Emes, the Emes of Torah, the truth of Torah, because it's reality. And God is saying this is the last moment that the Jewish people are going to be based in reality. From here on, it's going to be sheker, falsehood. It's going to be chinam, something that is objectively false. And therefore, from this moment on, after the Vayehi bin Soaron, when you get to Bamidbar 2, the second book of Numbers, as we describe that, from the point of that second nun to the end of the book, it's sort of its own book. And where does it go? Oh my gosh. It goes downhill in a hurry, right? You have the spies. You have Korach, Moses' own cousin, trying to destroy him, and Aaron. You have Bilam, the wicked Bilam, coming to destroy the Jews. It just goes from worse to worse to worse. It doesn't get any better. So I would say that as soon as they leave Sinai, it's over. That relationship, a connection that the majority of the Jewish people had to reality, was shattered forever. So let's close with the following concept. Let's discuss this word chinam and how it relates to today. Let's just look at the Gaza conflict, okay? Our world is full of chinam. Non-reality has won the day. Just think about it for a moment, okay? People in our world who basically hate Jews, I think this is a truism, okay? If you support Hamas and their 4,500 acts of war, shooting from a civilian neighborhood, summarily into other civilian neighborhoods, not even knowing where the weapons are going, but just hoping that you're going to kill little five-year-old boys named Ido, or murder 82-year-old bubbies somewhere in Israel. If this is your intent, if you are a defender of Hamas, if you ignore the 4,500-plus war crimes committed by Hamas, which, unfortunately, a lot of our world, if you're following the debate, and I dare say I haven't even looked on the Facebooks and the Twitters and the TikToks, I'm sure it's beyond our minds. Our minds, you would lose your mind. You'd have to have like Band-Aids to hold your brain in your head if you went too far into the craziness that's out there. But I think it's very, very clear that if you can ignore the four, you don't even have to look at the context of how Hamas became Hamas. In other words, strip away the context, like the way the world likes to today, and just look 4,500 missiles shot at a civilian population. That's the beginning and the end. And if there's any interpretation of that, except in the most war crime heinous prism, then guess what? Congratulations, you're an anti-Semite. I mean, in my mind. And you're also a member of the Chinam Club, because objective reality has left the house. You've lost your mind. You're no longer willing to look at reality. You see a reality that you project. And again, we have a word for that. What do we call it when somebody projects their mind as if this is real? It's called insanity, my friends. It's called wickedness. And you need a really good psychiatrist or maybe a rubber room. But I hate to say this. This is reality. Each of us here on the call tonight and our learning tonight, I guarantee you, if you think about it, you've all experienced moments of absolute just awe. How could it be that people don't see the reality? In other words, just strip away the history. Don't get into the argument, whose land it's not, the history, whose grandma lived there. Just look at 2 weeks. That's all I ask to do. And I just don't quite understand how our world can get to the conclusions that it's getting to, except to say that what we just learned about, that Chinam factor, the fact that the Jewish people, I mean, we started it. Think about it for a moment, okay? We not only criticize the manna, we criticize the manna with a lie, with fish for free that didn't exist. So it's a disproven canard to object to God and Moshe's compassion and love for us as a pretext to complain. But the whole idea is it's zecharnu, though. We remember the fish that we had. Remember, these people were alive in Egypt. It's not a second or third hand memory. They're inventing history. And I dare say that that is the beginning of the end, because since then, history has been devolving to that point. Again, I don't want to go on ad nauseum. I think everyone, I'm sure, maybe wants to share a little something tonight. What's the refuah? Well, I guess a good psychologist might be a good start for some people. But I think, sadly, there isn't an obvious answer. There's not even an obvious answer for us. And I'll prove it to you, right? First Beis HaMikdash, the first temple, was lost for three really horrible crimes. Bloodletting, idolatry, and promiscuity. How long did it take to rebuild Temple 1? You know the answer. 70 years. We lost Temple 2 over Chinam, over non-reality. How long has it taken to rebuild that temple? Right, it hasn't happened. It's 2,000 years and counting. So that is, I guess, at the end of the day, the saddest, most tragic proof of how subtle this is. It's a gray area, because it's he says, she says. We don't really know. History, as we know, is very elusive, right? I remember as a kid learning that history is always written by the victors, never the vanquished. I remember asking my teacher about Hannibal, you know, the great Carthaginian general. And history, our history books weren't very kind to him. But then again, who wrote the history books? The Romans. So of course the Romans are not going to be very gracious to Hannibal. The very fact that they give him any credit at all for his maneuvers and his, you know, leadership abilities, like, it's a miracle. If they give him any credit at all, you know, probably Hannibal was 10 times the general that anyone that Rome had on their side, just based on the fact that the Romans give him some credit. But if history is written by the victors and never the vanquished, history is always a tenuous thing. Where does truth come from? So the only truth that we know is from our Torah, that is Emes. And unfortunately, sadly, today it's lacking in our world. So I can't give you any easy answers, I'm sorry. But for us, the Jewish people, we have a way back. And that way back is to not buy into these non-realities. It's to try to objectively frame not only our own personal space and what we do on a daily basis, but hopefully spread that type of approach to help others to see truth. And Yemirtz Hashem, I know it's a long road because between now and Tisha B'Av, Ninth Av, we are going to be dealing with this type of chinam in our world, and there isn't a real answer to it, except we must respond. We cannot allow the world to not respond. We have seen things, and I'll leave with this. I'm sure everyone on this call tonight is very disquieted about the violence that we have seen in New York and Los Angeles. It's just overt anti-Semitism. There's nothing else to call it. And I think that it's being soft-pedaled right now. And we, above all, have to let our elected officials know that it's just not acceptable that Jewish people are not allowed to just be predated against anymore. I think that's the simple thing. And again, little elements of chinam and how you report a story or misidentify a certain person in a story, they are all part of this fake narrative that began. Its roots are with the fish that we remember eating in Egypt, and it has plagued us ad hayom hazeh. So with that, we ask for Hashem's Ezra, his help, that Be'ezras Hashem, with God's help, that we should, at least for ourselves and for our own people, educate everyone in the reality of our world and face that reality. So I wish everyone an Erev Tov. I'm going to unmute everyone now. If you have any questions or comments, I would love to continue the dialogue. Thank you.